Hello and welcome to Behind the News. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics, and a themed show tonight about inequality. In about 5 or 7 minutes, we'll talk with Yuval Elmaleh. I hope I'm not mangling that name too badly, who is a sociologist at Bard College and author of a new book called Transmitting Inequality, Wealth and the American Family, about how inequality is transmitted across the generations and the centrality of wealth as opposed to income to that process. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll speak with someone who's been on this show before, Larry Bartels, a political scientist at Princeton, author of a new book called Unequal Democracy, The Political Economy of the New Gilded Age. Talked about partisan politics, the growth of inequality in the United States over the last 30, 35 years, how voters make their decisions, which is a very strange and murky process, believe me, and the effect of various public policies on inequality. Sometimes the discourse is that the increase in inequality we've seen in the United States and parts of the rest of the world, but not all of the rest of the world, over the last 20, 30 years, that's often spoken of as if it's just almost a force of nature. But in fact, there's a whole lot of deliberate policies that have contributed to that or could mitigate that if we so chose to pursue them. But we, whoever that may be, don't make that choice. Okay, before we get to that, some words in the economic news. And doubtless to the relief of many, nothing about the housing bust this week except to say it goes on and on and on. In other economic news, the inflation anxieties I've been talking about for weeks here took on even more salience in the last few days among central bankers and the financial markets who follow them. On Monday, Federal Reserve Chair Ben Bernanke gave a speech at an economic conference sponsored by the Boston Federal Reserve Bank that focused almost entirely on inflation. Early in the speech, Bernanke said, quote, "Although activity during the current quarter is likely to be weak, the risk that the economy has entered a substantial downturn appears to have diminished over the past month or so," end of quote. The Fed's deep interest rate cuts plus the stimulus checks the U.S. Treasury is sending out should provide a bit of lift to the economy in the coming months, said Bernanke, though he acknowledged that there were some downside risks, notably coming from the contraction in the housing market, sorry, I did mention it after all, and the rise in energy prices. Having dismissed, or at least considerably downplayed, the risks of a major economic accident in the coming months, Bernanke returned to his inflation worries. Central bankers and conventional economists place great weight on what business people and consumers expect on the inflation front because they think that such expectations can become self-fulfilling. For example, if you think prices are going to rise tomorrow, you'll hoard today, which will contribute to price pressures. A problem with this line is that inflation expectations are generally shaped by the present and recent past and don't seem to have all that much correlation with the future. They tell you more about what's been going on rather than what's likely to happen. But Bernanke and his colleagues are adamant that they don't want to be seen as patsies in the face of rising inflation. So he promised in the speech that Fed policymakers, quote, will strongly resist an erosion of longer-term inflation expectations. On Tuesday, I saw Richard Fisher, the hawkish right-wing president of the hawkish right-wing Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas, speaking at the Council on Foreign Relations. Fisher, an extreme inflation phobe within the Fed, was even more worried about the price specter than was Bernanke. Fisher said the U.S. economy was probably not in recession. He sees it as experiencing a bout of anemia that might take a while to clear up. Though I think the economy is in recession, I also think that it's entered a period of longer-term structural troubles, if you want to call it anemia. Go ahead. So the technical distinction of whether it's in recession or not isn't really all that important for now. It could be if things get substantially worse, but I think they're just going to just be kind of crummy for many years to come. Fisher was very concerned that if inflation is as high as it is when the economy is anemic, what will happen when it recovers? It's like inflation is likely to head even higher under those circumstances, or so he argued. In fact, inflation has generally been sticky early in recessions, and it only comes down late in the downturn, but then it stays down in the early stages of recovery. But right-wing hawks don't always speak from history or theory, even if they have fancy resumes like Fisher does. They speak from common sense and instinct, which is almost always in need of fact-checking. All this tough talk scared the markets for several days this week, which started thinking that the Fed now is going to begin raising interest rates in a few months, when in fact they'd been expecting the Fed to be cutting interest rates, if anything, in the coming months. I'm skeptical. I think that the Fed wants to talk tough while hoping that things just break their way as the year progresses. it's quite possible that this inflation scare is a bit of a bubble, just like the spike in oil prices, and it's getting close to bursting. All the attention to the issue is now giving some kind of support to the bubble theory. It's often the case that an economic trend is getting mature when it becomes an obsessive topic of conversation. Today's Financial Times, for example, has at least 7 articles in the main news section on inflation. One of them points out that in most of the countries whose central banks operate under formal inflation targets, that is, they're mandated either by law or promise to keep inflation under a certain specified level, typically 2 to 3% a year, almost all of those countries have inflation rates above that target, some of them substantially above. But what are they going to do about it? Will they create recessions by driving up interest rates in the hope of bringing inflation back down to their comfort range? I'm not convinced that they're willing to do that yet. Even though Western Europe's inflation is the highest it's been in 16 years, their economy is also showing its first signs of life in ages. Will they choke it off, just to make a point about inflation? Will the Chinese risk political instability by throttling back on their 10% growth rate? And can they even fine-tune it, or do they run the risk of derailing the whole 20-year boom? And does our own Federal Reserve really believe that our economy and financial system are robust enough to withstand a tightening coming sooner rather than later? They've almost never started raising interest rates until the unemployment rate was well off its recession high, and I don't think we've even reached its peak for this slowdown yet. Federal Reserve statistics released last week show that U.S. households took a big financial hit to their net worth in the first quarter of 2008, with debts rising as assets values fell, and not just houses, but financial assets as well. The job market is weakening, and Americans are in a very sour mood, although Thursday's strong retail sales figures show that they seem to be spending more of their stimulus checks than they'd planned to, at least according to what they were telling pollsters a few weeks ago. But in this kind of difficult environment, especially in the run-up to an election, the Fed is very, very unlikely to do anything hostile. There's a tendency on the political left not to take inflation seriously. I think that can be a real mistake. Rising prices can hurt the poor and working class a lot, and a sense that inflation is out of control can often lead to popular support for reactionary, authoritarian clampdown policies. But as I've been arguing here for weeks, the current bout of inflation is heavily about real things: constraints in the supply of oil, political trouble in oil-producing regions, climate change leading to crop failures that push food prices higher. These are not problems that admit of monetary solution. Inflation is a problem, but its solution is not named Bernanke or Fisher. And speaking of the Financial Times, here's a sentence from today's paper that will shock anyone who grew up during the Cold War. Quote, Vietnam's Ho Chi Minh Index, once a growth story, is down 66% from its peak. Ho Chi Minh, from revolutionary to eponymous trail for guerrilla warriors, now to emerging market stock index. Oh, and Cuba has dropped its egalitarian policy on pay and is now offering managers 30% bonuses if their teams show strong productivity increases, which isn't a bad lead-in to a show about inequality. Okay, time for a musical break, and we'll be back to speak with Yuval Elmerich. A bit of Schubert's first piano sonata, the first movement performed by Andras Schiff. A bit of youthful work from a guy who died at 31, so I guess he was pretty youthful when he wrote that one. We're now joined on the line by Yuval Elmerich, who is a professor of sociology at Bard and author of the book Transmitting Inequality, just out from Roman and Littlefield. And I hope I'm not mangling your name too badly.
No, I heard worse version of it.
Okay, well, I apologize.
It was pretty good, actually.
So, first of all, you're talking in this book mostly about wealth rather than income. I think a lot of people may not appreciate the distinction, and why is wealth so important for understanding inequality over time?
Well, wealth is a measure of economic status that differs from other economic measures in that it captures more than sheer monetary advantage. As a stock of material resources, control over private property and wealth has unique consequences to economic, social, and psychological well-being of the owner. I usually ask in my classes that I teach on inequality, for example, I ask students if the following question: if they were had the opportunity to leave college and never to return to complete their BA, in return for $2 million, how many of them would accept the offer? And the vast majority always raised their hand and said, "We will." When I asked the students who declined the offer why they did it, a couple of years ago, one student told me that her grandparents are very old, and they will leave her millions of dollars. So the $2 million that I offered was obviously didn't impress her. So wealth is really a stock of material resources, and most people work and have income and try to increase their income in order to accumulate wealth and reach this level of security, of financial comfort.
And I would guess that most people are not very successful at accumulating large amounts of wealth out of current income, are they?
True. Wealth is actually more unevenly distributed in the population than income. And it is more unevenly distributed in the U.S. than in other industrial societies. For example, more than half, about 60% of the total net worth in the U.S., is owned by the wealthiest 5% of the population, whereas the bottom 50% hold less than 3% of the country's wealth. So the reasons for this inequality, this extreme inequality, are numerous. And in this book, I focus on both institutional and historical explanations and demographic explanations.
I'll get to those in a moment. But what does wealth do for someone? Obviously, it's nice to have $2 million. It's nicer to have $2 million in the bank than have be $50,000 in credit card debt. But aside from the emotional difference, what does having a stock of wealth do for someone's life?
It enables them to live in comfort. It provides some financial security, and they don't feel the need to either be too much, dependent on either labor or welfare. So you can actually, wealth can finance consumption during times of economic crisis, like illness in the family or losing one's job or divorce or other unexpected expenses.
Now, early in the book, you talk about the transformation of our economic lives from a very home-based production to a much more marketized, commoditized world. What has that done to the nature of wealth, say, over the course of the 20th century?
Well, we have seen two interesting and dramatic changes in the concept of private property and its relation to work. And this is what I'm really interested is in the link between one's position in the labor market and his position in the commodity market in terms of property ownership. So we have seen in the past century, we have seen two kind of stages in this kind of relationship between labor and property. One was the shift, as you suggested, the shift from ownership of land, productive property, to home ownership. And this took place mainly between 1940 and 1960, when homeownership rates had increased by almost 50%, from 43% to 62%. The next stage was actually the shift from household wealth that was held mainly in housing to a very diverse asset portfolio. So the U.S. has witnessed a dramatic shift from functional domestic property to more diverse wealth portfolio. And this transition is attributed to various institutional changes in the market, such as the emergence of financial intermediaries that expand asset holding and diversify the wealth portfolio of, again, mainly middle-class families. The poor were largely excluded from these benefits of ownership, home ownership, stocks ownership, access to retirement accounts, and so on.
Now, this sort of parallels the transformation of the ownership of productive property from proprietorships and small partnerships to large firms that are owned by diverse shareholders, dispersed shareholders. So you're talking about the asset side of this. Rich people now own these assets, which represent claims on productive property, right?
True.
And these have grown in size and complexity and diversity over time, even relative to the economy. Growth in financial assets has far outstripped the growth in GDP, for example.
Yeah.
Now, we hear a lot about the decline of family ties. We hear about divorce, and nobody has dinner together anymore, and there's tension between the generations. And we just thought that the family has declined in importance as an economic unit over the last century or two. How true is that from your work?
Well, the evidence that I provide, the data that I use, does actually do not provide support to this hypothesis, and also it does not provide support to the generational conflict hypothesis. What I found actually is that, and this is the subtitle of the book, is that the American family played a significant role in both wealth buildup and its perpetuation, its intergenerational transmission. And there are two key kind of variables that I look at. One is marriage. Marriage and wealth are closely related. And the amount of net worth among households maintained by married couples is about five times greater than the amount of net worth held by a household maintained by either single woman or man. While marriage is associated with wealth, divorce has a very strong negative impact on living standards. However, the key here is to move from the individual, kind of the micro-level analysis to the more macro-societal level. And here what we found is that there is a very strong pattern of homogamy in the marriage market. In other words, wealthy people tend to marry with people who are similar to them, who are wealthy, who are highly educated, and this homogamy is based on race and ethnicity and education and wealth. So when we talk about the breakup of the American family, the evidence that I present in the book, and this is based on both behavior, the amount of money that parents leave to their children, and in terms of attitudes toward such transfers, and I find a very strong intergenerational ties between grandparents and grandchildren, parents and their children, the young and the old. So it works both within families and across generations.
Now, are these family ties tighter among better-off people than they are among poorer people?
It's a different when you focus on the financial aspect of these ties, it is evident that poor people have very little to offer to their family members. So the exchanges are more visible among, obviously, among people who have wealth to share with children or with elderly parents.
I'm speaking with Yuval Elmelech, who is a professor of sociology at Bard and author of the book Transmitting Inequality, Wealth in the American Family, just out from Roman Littlefeld. And well, there are ways in which this inequality is transmitted. Of course, the most direct being inheritance. How big a role does inheritance play in wealth inequality?
A big role. Some evidence on the attempt to assess the wealth and the component of inheritance out of total wealth are inconclusive. It depends on whether the authors or the scholars include only inheritance or incorporate also inter vivos gifts, that is, a transfer that people make during their lifetime. Now, today we know that the vast majority of intergenerational transfers are actually transferred during one's lifetime and in the form of support in education, assistance that parents give to their children in a purchase of a house or starting a business. So there is a shift. There has been a shift in the 20th century from mainly inheritance to inter vivos transfers that boost the economic well-being of children.
And you also present evidence on international comparisons, Americans versus people from other countries. What do those show?
They show that Americans have a strong... They show two things, two key things. One is Americans believe in individualism. So there is a very strong emphasis on individual effort as a means to experience economic mobility. At the same time, this notion of individualism is tied very closely to familism. So Americans, more than citizens of other European countries, and I include about six or seven European countries in this cross-national comparison, are more likely to argue that it is the responsibility of the parents to help their children, financially help the children, it's the responsibility of children to assist their elderly parents. And when you ask Americans who would they look for when they need assistance, would they approach their bank or they look or family members or neighbors, the majority would list their parents as the first person or parents that they would ask for assistance.
And does the nature of the welfare state in which people live have any impact on these sort of family attitudes?
Yes, this is a very good point. I think it's the lack of welfare provision that contribute to the strong link between generations and within families. So the safety net is provided by private means and not public means.
And of course we have credit cards if people get into real trouble.
And
you also present evidence on enormous racial disparities in wealth. We know that income disparities are very wide, but the wealth disparities are even wider, aren't they?
Yes. And I link this to both part of the explanation for the racial and ethnic gaps between white on the one hand and blacks and Latinos on the other is to some extent, this is the result of unequal family transfers. So the amount of wealth that white receive from their families is much greater than the amount that blacks and Latinos receive. And also, especially when you look at the black community, the marriage and divorce are detrimental to the wealth level of blacks. Now, this is when we look at this demographic characteristic like family and to some extent family transfers. But again, this minority household also experience double disadvantage in both the labor market and in the commodity market. So first, they have lower incomes and a lower employment rates than in comparison to white. But when they try to convert their earnings into assets, they face another kind of very distinct opportunity structure that involve institutional discrimination in the housing market and the credit market.
And you mentioned housing earlier, the great explosion of home ownership between the 1940s and through the 1960s. Are houses really a great way for middle-income people to accumulate wealth, or is it just it just gets tied up in a residence and they can't really draw on the wealth?
Well, today they can. So you can convert, actually, your home equity and use the money to for consumption or for investment. And this is one part of the kind of story about the financialization of the market. So people have more access today, and they can liquidate their home equity and use it for, again, consumption or investment. So even housing became, in a way, a financial asset.
And we've only got a minute or so left, but we reserve the last minute of for the what is to be done question. Is there anything that we could do to reduce this level of wealth inequality, or is it just so baked in that it'd be hard to do much of anything about it?
I think we should pay more attention to asset-based policies in order to, again, both support single-parent families and the poor in order to enhance, to boost their asset ownership and wealth accumulation, but we have to do it very carefully and take into account the unique characteristics of the ethnic and racial groups, particularly, again, African Americans and Latinos, and also whether these families can use the wealth in order to invest it in human capital or purchasing of a home or starting a business.
Now, the people of some politicians have proposed schemes in which the government, say, will match deposits to a savings account. Is that a good idea, do you think?
Yes, yes. I think that's and there are several scholars who work on this, and recent evidence suggests that even the poor can save if they have the kind of means and assistance. In the past, the argument was that, you know, the poor will not be able to save because they don't have the money. But it seems that it changed their saving behavior if there is a target, an end that they can try. So I think that the whole concept that many people share, that poverty or lack of wealth is a result of you know, different work ethics or culture of poverty, is basically is not true. If you provide more opportunities and improve the assets or provide opportunities to access to valuable assets, people will save and will be able to improve their life chances and their children's life chances.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us. I've been speaking with Yuval Elimelech, who is a professor of sociology at Bard and author of Transmitting Inequality, Wealth and the American Family, just out from Roman and Littlefield. Let's take a break, and we'll be back to talk with Larry Bartels.
Hi, this is Lloyd Price, and you're tuned to WBAI New York. Listener-supported, non-commercial radio.
Okay.
Oh, no, Lord, 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 Miss Lord.
And this is WBAI, 99.5 on your FM dial in New York, but also on the web at WBAI.org. My name is Doug Henwood. The program is Behind the News, and let's listen to this from a new CD by a new band called The Ampersands. The album is called And, and this is a bit of the first cut of the album, Time Travel. And that a bit of Time Travel by the Ampersands. And if you want to find out more about them, you can find them in the usual places like Facebook and MySpace. I can pretend to be a young person, too, just like everyone else. And now we're joined on the line by Larry Bartels, who is a professor of political science at Princeton and author of the new book, Unequal Democracy, The Political Economy of the New Gilded Age, just out from Princeton University Press and the Russell Sage Foundation. Welcome, Larry Bartels.
Hi, Doug.
The growing inequality the United States has experienced over the last 30 or so years is often presented as a fact of nature, you know, like the sun rises in the east and we just get more unequal over time. It's not quite such a force of nature, is it?
No. There are external economic conditions and technological changes that have contributed to exacerbating economic inequality, but there are also very consequential policy choices that have made a big difference, not only in this recent period of increasing inequality, but more generally throughout American political history.
And I was surprised to discover, reading your book, that much of the increase, almost all of it, the increase in inequality since the late 60s, early 70s, when they had the peak of egalitarianism in modern American history, much of that increase, if not all of it, came during Republican administrations, right?
Yeah, that's right. There's a very striking pattern in income growth under Democratic and Republican presidents over the period that we've been able to track it, which goes back to the late 1940s, actually. Income growth has been pretty high and remarkably equal in proportional terms for people in all different parts of the income distribution under Democratic presidents. But under Republican presidents, middle-income people have done much less well than upper-income people, and working poor people have done even less well than that. So the difference in average income gains for people in the middle and bottom of the income distribution are really quite striking.
And this is kind of interesting, you know, given the popularity of the idea that there's not a dime's worth of difference, as George Wallace used to say. Apparently there is at least a dime's worth of difference, isn't there?
Yeah, a great deal of difference.
You know, you said in your intro that you started this project as a neutral political scientist and ended up coming up with some rather partisan conclusions. What happened?
Well, I started looking at the data expecting to find that there would be differences attributable to partisan policy differences, since we know that there have been pretty consistent ideological differences in what Republicans and Democrats have tried to do in the modern political period. But I was struck by the magnitude of those differences and by the extent to which Democratic presidents seem to do better for middle and poor income people than Republican presidents did.
Now, the big question is, why isn't this better known? You say early on in the book, in sort of aphoristic sentence, any serious attempt to understand a political economy of the new Gilded Age requires grappling with the political psychology of American voters, with the real limitations of public opinion as a basis for democratic policymaking. I think we could spend the rest of the half hour talking about just what that all means. But what is operating that the voters don't seem to really get what's going on?
Well, there's a lot of evidence suggesting that the economy plays a big role in presidential elections and that incumbent parties are rewarded for economic success and punished for economic failure. And so putting that fact together with the disparities in income growth that I just described, you'd think that it would be hard for Republicans ever to win, but it turns out that they have won pretty frequently in the last 50 or 60 years. And the reason for that turns out to have a lot to do with the myopia of voters. They do vote on the basis of economic conditions, but it turns out that they focus very heavily on how the economy is going at the time of the election and pay much less attention to previous economic performance. And it turns out that in election years, Republican presidents do better even for middle and low income people than Democratic presidents do. It's just the other years where Democrats are so much better, and people seem to forget that consistently when they're in the voting booth.
Now, the cliche is that presidents are most likely to have recessions early in their term and then try to engineer expansions later in their term so they can get reelected. That there's a more partisan pattern to that than that cliche, though, right?
Yeah, the typical pattern under Republican administrations is that a new president comes in and tries to contract the economy and produces a slowdown and often a recession that appears in the second year of the administration, and then economic growth begins to increase after that, and by the time of the next election in year four, the economy is doing pretty well. But under Democratic presidents, the typical pattern is actually exactly the reverse, which is to say they come in and implement expansionary policies and employment and production increase a lot. There's a big boom in year two of their administration, and then that growth rate kind of declines in year three and year four, and by the time the next election comes around, things are much slower than they have been. And that's the point at which voters tend to punish them, having forgotten all of that income growth in the earlier part of their administration.
Well, it's as if George W. Bush is now the Republican Jimmy Carter, because he's having a more Democratic pattern in his second term than a Republican one. Let's talk about a couple of other cliches that are out there in the among the political pundits. One is that the voters have moved tremendously to the right over the years, and particularly working-class voters, working-class white voters, have moved in a Republican direction over the years. That's not true, is it?
It doesn't seem to be. There's been a big shift among lots of white voters in the South toward the Republican Party, stemming from the realignment in the early 1960s when the Democrats first adopted an aggressive position in favor of civil rights for African Americans. That produced a big shift that continued for decades thereafter. But aside from that, there doesn't seem to be a big shift in the Republican direction among low-income white voters. The movement in the Republican direction is really much more among more affluent white voters.
Who, of course, dominate the electorate, right?
Well, they do, but there are also lots of less affluent people there as well. And so the partisan balance in recent elections has really been quite even.
And you and also Jeffrey Stonecash have done a lot of work just showing that the idea, as we said earlier, that there isn't a dime's worth of difference isn't true. There's much more distinct policy differences among and voting patterns, even in the partisan class-based voting patterns than there used to be. Isn't that true?
Yeah, that's right. You see lots of voting on the basis of economic issues among low-income people. It turns out, though, that the people who are voting on the basis of social and cultural issues tend to be much more the affluent people rather than lower-income people. And so although there are some culturally conservative working-class whites who've moved in the Republican direction, there are probably many more culturally liberal, affluent whites who've moved in the Democratic direction as a result of the increasing salience of social issues in the last 20 years or so.
Yeah, then let's look a little more closely at that, because Tom Frank made a big splash back in 2004 when he wrote in What's the Matter with Kansas, and argued that the Republicans have pulled a great confidence trick in convincing working-class white voters to vote against their own interests because they're much more concerned about gay marriage than they are about their economic fate. You don't find anything like that phenomenon that Tom Frank was writing about, do you?
No, the people who seem to be voting more on the basis of abortion and gay marriage and gun control are people in the middle and especially upper-income groups rather than the low-income group.
And you also you did mention that cultural issues seem to have greater salience. That's all the result of a shift among the interests of upper-income voters?
Right. What's happened is that they have increasingly come to rely on those issues in determining how they're going to vote at the presidential level.
I'm speaking with Larry Bartels, a professor of political science at Princeton University and author of Unequal Democracy, just out from Princeton University Press and the Russell Sage Foundation. Well, let's look at a couple of specific issues that very important recent tax policy. First of all, Bush's tax cuts, which he proposed on taking office in 2001. What formed people's thinking about whether they're for or against those tax cuts?
Well, there was generally a lot of public support for the tax cuts among people who were paying attention and had any opinion at all. Though one of the things that's really striking, given the multi-trillion dollar stakes, is how many people were willing to tell survey researchers that they hadn't really thought about the idea or hadn't decided whether they were for or against the tax cuts. But the people who were for them were generally for them because they had the impression that there was something in it for them, which there was. The policy was carefully crafted so that they'd be able to say that everyone would get a tax cut, that is, everyone who was paying federal income taxes. And people's views about the tax cut then seemed to be strongly related to their sense of their own tax burden. People who thought that they paid too much in taxes themselves were very likely to be supportive, even though what they were going to get out of it was really quite small by comparison with the huge tax cuts for more affluent people.
So if they're going to get a dollar a day, they're happy to give Steve Schwarzman $1,000 a day, in other words.
That's right. And as a result, their views were sometimes in pretty stark apparent contradiction to lots of other things that they claim to believe or care about. So people who wanted to spend more money on government programs were especially likely to want to cut taxes at the same time. And as a result, we have a kind of chronic imbalance now between revenues and what the government needs to spend in order to provide the sorts of services that we say we want.
Is this a problem of being poorly informed, or is it something more complicated than that?
Well, in the case of the tax cuts, it does seem to be largely that. If you look at how people's views about the tax cuts change as they become better informed about politics, it turns out that Republicans were quite likely to be supportive, regardless of whether they were paying a lot of attention to politics or not. But the big shift came on the part of Democrats. The best informed Democrats were quite likely to oppose the Bush tax cuts, but less well-informed Democrats were quite supportive and provided a crucial plurality of public support for the policy.
The picture is a little different when it comes to the estate tax. There was broad popular support for that, even though, you know, that was a very, very small portion of very rich taxpayers who would be affected by it. But how do you explain public support for repealing a tax that only falls on millionaires?
Well, in that case, it seemed to have a lot to do with a kind of peculiar dislike of the tax itself that goes back a long way in American political history, as best we can tell. There's a view that what happened was that right-wing interest groups managed to generate a bunch of antipathy and convince people that this was something that we should get rid of. But it turns out that if you go back to interviews that were done in the 1970s, most working people were already pretty strongly opposed to the estate tax on the grounds that it interfered with family values and the right of people to pass what they had earned onto their children. And there's a lot of public antipathy to the estate tax, even again among people who have lots of other values and policy preferences that you think would predispose them to support the estate tax. So people who think that the rich are not paying their fair share nevertheless want to repeal the estate tax, and people who recognize that they themselves are never going to pay it nevertheless want to repeal it, and people who want to spend lots of money on government programs nevertheless want to repeal it, and people who are concerned about increasing economic inequality nevertheless want to repeal the estate tax. So there's a lot of durability to that view, even among people who have lots of other more progressive-sounding policy preferences and values.
And again, this is not really a matter of being well-informed?
Well, it looks as though if people were better informed about the details of the estate tax, they would be somewhat more supportive of it, but still there'd be a good deal of antipathy. And if it was up to the public, the estate tax probably would have been repealed a long time ago.
And minimum wage. Supposedly has broad public support. How does that translate into policy?
Well, the short answer is that it doesn't. We've seen a dramatic decline in the real value of the minimum wage over the last 40 years or so. That's happened mostly under Republican presidents. It seems to have something to do with the declining influence of labor unions, but also a lot to do with the ideology of Republican elites who always dislike the minimum wage and are happy to let it erode by not producing periodic increases as long as they can avoid it.
You write some in the book about how people sort of conform their opinions to the relevant elites that are, I guess, the opinion formers. Could you talk a bit about that process?
Well, people are paying some attention to the political world, but it's very hard for them to figure out the details of policy and what kinds of consequences specific policies will have. And so they take much of their views about these things from the media and from political figures that they have some reason to think they can trust. And as a result, you see sometimes funny patterns in people's beliefs. For example, there are questions in some surveys that simply ask people whether the difference in incomes between rich people and poor people has increased recently. And the answer to that, as I've tried to describe, is certainly yes. And most people recognize that that's the case, but many people don't. In general, people who are better informed and more attentive to politics are more likely to recognize that. But if you look at conservatives, the conservatives who are best informed are actually the ones who are more likely to deny that income inequality has increased. And that's not because the reality is unclear. It's because I think they're taking their cues from political elites on that side of the spectrum who would like it to be the case that inequality hasn't really increased.
And you've got a chapter on whether elected representatives listen to their constituents when separated by income class. What's the answer?
The answer is they listen to some, but not all. The economic inequality that I describe in much of the book turns out to have profound impacts for the political system in ways that are kind of disturbing to the familiar notion that it's okay for some of us to be rich and some of us to be poor as long as we're all equal in the democratic system. What I did was to look at the behavior of U.S. senators and how they voted on a whole array of issues and to relate that behavior to the views of their constituents, but dividing the constituents into low-income, middle-income, and high-income groups. And it turns out that there's some responsiveness to people in the middle of the income distribution and somewhat more responsiveness, especially by Republicans, to people at the top of the income distribution, but no responsiveness by senators of either party to constituents whose incomes put them in the bottom third of the distribution. So that's millions of people, many of whom are regular voters whose policy preferences seem to be entirely ignored by their elected officials.
Of course, our founding fathers famously reflected on all this. Madison in Federalist 10 said that we had to devise a system which kept harebrained schemes that were designed to appropriate property, keep those to a minimum. It seems like they were pretty successful at devising the system that protected the privilege of the wealthy.
Well, there's been a lot of concern among political theorists going back for centuries, even to Aristotle, that the effect of democracy would be to expropriate rich people. And that certainly doesn't seem to be the case in our democracy. It has something to do with the institutions that have been constructed and the way that they provide unequal influence to the people who have economic resources. But it also has a lot to do with the views of ordinary people who have been convinced and convinced themselves that they don't want to expropriate rich people either. There's a strong ideology in favor of the notion that people should be able to keep what they earn.
But do you have got a chapter on this? Do Americans care about inequality? The immediate answer usually is no, but is that true?
They do seem to care about inequality. If you ask them abstract questions, they sound very egalitarian. There was a question in some of these surveys that asked them to agree or disagree whether we should do everything that's necessary to be sure that everyone has an equal opportunity to succeed. And over 80% of Americans agreed with that sentiment. The problem, if there's a problem, is that they're less likely to translate that sentiment into practical policy preferences. So lots of these people who say we should do everything we can to ensure equal opportunity at the same time are happy to have an estate tax repeal that allows multimillionaires to pass their wealth on to their children and are unlikely to want to spend money on inner city schools in order to give kids who live in those places the kind of education that they would need to succeed in the modern economy.
Well, we often see things like, for example, in I think 2004, something like half or more of Bush's voters thought he supported the Kyoto Protocol. That you can make a long list of that sort of confusion. What is up with that? Do voters just not understand, or there's some sort of complex psychology at work? How do you explain this disconnect between what people believe on specific issues and how they vote?
Well, part of the problem is what they believe. Some of their perceptions, as you suggested, are actually misperceptions. That has to do with lack of attention on one hand and taking cues from unreliable sources of information on the other. Having said that, the question is, whatever they do believe, how does that get translated into voting behavior? And the answer is that sometimes it does and sometimes it doesn't, depending in part on the elite discourse and the kinds of cues that people get about what issues are important, but also in part about what they want to believe given their overall values. One of the things I've done is to look at the extent to which people's partisan values color their perceptions of the world. And it turns out that there are very big differences between Republicans and Democrats about even strictly objective kinds of issues. For example, at the end of the Reagan administration, people were asked whether unemployment and inflation had gone up or gone down, and the majority of strong Democrats said that inflation had gotten worse during Reagan's administration, when in fact it had fallen dramatically.
All right, well, there's no end to what one can do in trying to figure out why people think and act the way they do. Thank you for joining us. I've been speaking with Larry Bartels, who is the author of Unequal Democracy, The Political Economy of the New Gilded Age, just out from Princeton University Press and the Russell Sage Foundation. Larry Bartels teaches at Princeton University, and you can find many of his papers on his website at Princeton. Just search for his name, and it'll pop up there, and you can read and also pick up the book for more detail. Okay, that's it for me, Doug Henwood. I will be back next week. Let's go out with this. Actually, I read in the New York Times that there's a new coffee table book devoted to the No Wave era, New York music back in 1978, a hostile bit of hyperpunk lasted for a short period of time and then burned out, which made me pull off the shelf this a little bit by James Chance and the Contortions, I Can't Stand Myself. Till next week. Bye. Hey! Well, you let me-